Welcome to the Biohacking Superhuman Performance Podcast. My name is Natalie Nidham. I'm a nutritionist, a human potential and epigenetic coach, and I created this podcast to bring you the latest ways to take control of your health and longevity. We cover it all, from new technology to ancestral health practices, personalized interventions, and a very special interest of mine, peptides. Enjoy the show.
Welcome back, guys. It's time for another episode, and today's episode is all about tapping into your immune system so that your body can release extra weight. So what's up with that, Nat? What does my immune system have to do with weight loss or with fat loss? Well, today's guest is going to tell you all about it. His name is Joel Green. He wrote a book called The Immunity Code about a year ago. And when I first found out about this book, I was so intrigued by it that I ordered a copy right away. Turns out I didn't get it because they had trouble with international shipping, and it took me a long time to figure out that I didn't receive the book. And when I finally remembered, I sent an email to the company, and who should answer me but Joel Green himself. So how lucky am I that he did that, and even luckier that he agreed to come on the podcast and talk to you guys about this book. So it's a different approach. His goal for people is really to stop the crazy restrictive diets, whether we're talking keto or carnivore or vegan or whatever the case may be, and be able to have the flexibility to eat many, many different things and feel great and look great at the same time. So as you can tell from the title of the book, he goes at it quite differently than most people. And he also will guide you through this book through a microbiome reset, which I'm currently in the middle of doing. And I got to tell you guys, I've done a lot of microbiome resets in my day. I'm a nutritionist and I'm pretty impressed with this one because it is shifting things in my gut that I don't think I've felt shift in a very long time. So anyway, it's definitely worth a read. I hope you enjoy this episode. Joel's a great guy. We had a really nice conversation. So if you're looking to connect with Joel, the best way is through his company, which is veepnutrition.com. Veep is V like Victor, E-E-P like Paul. nutrition.com. The links will be in the show notes. His book is The Immunity Code, which you can buy either from Amazon or you can buy from his website. But he's got a couple of really great programs that he sells through his website to help people do exactly what I'm doing, which is reset their gut. So I highly recommend him and this program, and especially the book. If you're looking to connect with me, if you have any comments, questions, or whatever, you know where to find me. And if you don't, it's Natalie Nidham on Instagram, Natalie Nidham on Clubhouse, Biohacking Superhuman Performance Group on MeWe, and it's the Biohacking Superhuman Performance Group or Optimizing Superhuman Performance on Facebook. And also my website, natnidham.com. So thank you so much for being here, you guys. Remember that any comments or questions, please send them through to me. If you get value from this episode, please share it out. Leave me comments or questions. Leave a review. Really important for the podcast because it helps us to be seen and it helps me to get you amazing guests. And finally, remember that all of the information that we share on this podcast is just that, just information purposes only. We're not helping to treat, diagnose, or anything of the sort with any kind of diseases or medical conditions, anything like that. Before making any changes, please consult with your medical doctor or medical practitioner so that you can get clearance and make sure that this is right for you. Without further ado, enjoy the episode. Hey folks, this episode is brought to you by Primadine. Primadine is a food-based supplement with an extremely high safety profile that actually halts 6 of the 9 hallmarks of aging. It is the purest on the market with 0 fillers and a formulation that also supports the endogenous production of spermidine through a prebiotic. Spermidine happens to be the active ingredient in Primadine. And if you go back and listen to the podcast episodes that I recorded with Amy Lamott and Leslie Kenny late last year, actually early this year and in December of last year, you'll learn all about Spermidine and why I am so excited about this supplement and why I take it and my parents take it. pretty much all of my clients take it as well. It is a very powerful tool in the healthy aging toolkit. Okay, back to telling you a bit more about this particular supplement. It also contains a prebiotic that allows your body to make its own spermidine, because your body can make some, but our bodies after the age of 50 start to make a lot less of it. So the only ingredients in the supplement are defatted concentrated wheat germ extract. So they defat it so that those delicate oils won't go rancid and then become an inflammatory problem for your body. There's a fructooligosaccharide, which is the prebiotic we were talking about, which selectively feeds the Fuso and Bacteriades bacteria in the gut microbiome. Also, all this is all wrapped up in a vegan capsule. I can tell you a little bit about my experience and my mom and dad's experience. One of the things about Primadine that's amazing is that after about 30 to 60 days, you don't really see what's happening under the hood. You don't see that your DNA is being folded properly. You don't see that autophagy is supported. You might not notice that your mitochondria are working better. But what you will notice is that your hair, skin, and nails start to look a lot better. In my case, after about 30 days, I noticed it in my nails. They were a lot stronger. They stopped breaking. And in my mom's case, she noticed it in her hair. As a matter of fact, she not only noticed it, but my dad noticed it. And that's amazing, because my dad doesn't generally comment on these things. And he actually picked up the phone to call me and say, "Hey, did you know that your mother's hair has gotten so much thicker? Is it possible that it's that supplement you have us taking?" And I was like, "Yeah, as a matter of fact, it is." So I've been recommending this supplement now probably for the last 5 to 6 months. All of my clients take it who are willing to do so. And I definitely recommend you give it a shot. It takes about 30 to 60 days to notice the benefits on the outside, even though the benefits are happening on the inside. So you can go to primadine.com and you can use promo code BIONAT15. So bio, B-I-O, NAT, N-A-T, 15. And that will get you 15% off of your purchase. And you get to use that promo code every time you go back to restock. So enjoy the episode. And if you decide to use Primadine, make sure that you let me know how you did. Hello, Joel. It's such a pleasure to meet you. Thank you so much for taking time to talk to me today.
Yes, thank you very much, Natalie. I'm very honored to be here.
Well, I'm very honored to host you. So here you go. We're the honored group. So Joel, you've just, I guess it's been a couple of months now. When did you release the immunity code?
Last year.
Yeah, I tried to get my hands on it and I couldn't. There was something happened with international shipping because I live in the Great White North or something. And
oh yeah, it was pre-COVID, as a matter of fact, that it came out. It came out actually in 2019 in December. So, but it didn't really catch on till like kind of COVID, and then it kind of exploded.
I wonder why. Could it be the maybe the immunity code? It's pretty topical, right?
It is now, yeah.
Well, I mean, truthfully, I think it is. It's been always, but if anything was going to light a fire under people, it's been the last. Can you believe it's going to be a year and a half soon? Like it's been the last 15 months or whatever. That's just this heave ho in the world. So, I think a place I really like to start with my guests is to ask them how they got to where they are today. What drove you to do what you do? Like, I know you've been at what you do a lot longer than it looks like you are old. So tell us about
that? Yeah.
I'm 70. So
a very polite way of saying he's older than dirt.
A polite way of saying you look really young and your resume looks like you've been around a lot longer. So.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah. Quick synopsis, high level would be a bunch of rumbling, stumbling, and bump. That would be the best way to really kind of summarize the whole thing. Like, never planned on any of this, but physical fitness and nutrition, it was just part of my life from the time I was 5 and I turned on the tube and there was Jack Elaine, and it just, you know, I was an acolyte of Jack. So I grew up with it, and it was something that every step of the, you trace all these sort of planks of the consumer adoption of health as a lifestyle or as a way of life. And I was just there in that, you know, like in the early, some of the demarcation points were 1972. Frank Shorter took the silver medal in the marathon. And so by the way, I'm 56. So, you know, I was kicking during that house and became like running became a thing. And so in third, fourth grade, I just started running, you know, because running became this thing. And then, bodybuilding kind of like would be featured on Wide World of Sports on ABC. And I watched Pumping Iron and, you know, kind of got into all Arnold's biography and reading all that stuff. And so I got into Olympic lifting right about ninth grade, and I ride my skateboard 5 miles every day and just do, I was really, I think my motivation was I was so skinny. I was almost 6'3" by my freshman year. And I was, I was 160. So I'm 220 right now. So you can imagine, I mean, you know, so I used to wear like long sleeve shirts every day because I was so terrified. I had such, you know, skinny arms. So I was just really interested in like not being so skinny, I think was part of it. And then I was always into athletics anyway. And, along with that kind of came, because of so much reading, I was always really into reading and science and all that. And I just had a passion for it. And I was kind of like riding the wave of the mid 80s, 90s, when fitness became kind of a thing in our culture. And it was really just, my experiences were just really the experiences most consumers have, you know, like nowadays what we have is biohacking's a thing. And so you have a lot more sophisticated sort of entree into things, you know, where, you know, you're coming in and your starting point's autophagy, you know, which wasn't even a word back in 2017. Like nobody knew what that word was. So there's this much more rapid adoption, which incidentally in the book I made a case for, just in terms of the lexicon of health. I made the case that there are new words, like in the same way that DNA is just part of the everyday lexicon now. And in the 50s, only scientists knew what that was. But I made the case that NAD and CD38 and HDAC inhibition, that those words would be part of the new lexicon. And I think that's going to happen a lot faster than I predicted. It'll probably happen in the next kind of 3 years, 4 years, I think, that we'll see that happen. So I was just really, as a consumer, doing everything that you might think of today as sort of like mainstream. And that was, you know, looking at, what you would call fasting, what you would call macro counting, you know, what you call high protein diets, all that is doing everything. And
even really, HIIT, like in your book, you talk about you were doing HIIT before anybody knew what HIIT was, kind of.
Well, I was a track and field guy, and a guy named Bud Winter wrote a book called Relax and Win back in the 80s. He was one of the head coaches at San Jose State. And it was really all about interval training, you know? And so I just kind of grew up with interval training, and it was like part of my regular exercise thing. So I would, I remember 1989, 90, I was at UCI, and I had class, you know, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and then Tuesdays I would go to the gym, and my gym were like Boyer Co. and, you know, all these bodybuilders would train. And so I'd go, you know, just kind of like be a little geek around and kind of, you know, try and steal glimpses of those guys. Then I'd go to track and I would run intervals. And so that was just part of what I was doing the whole time. But I think my experience really was very relevant to today, because what happened to me was what I see a lot happening now, where I have people coming to me. And what happened to me was I would do protocols. And like I did what you would call time-restricted feeding, really in the early 90s. And I looked great. I got really, really ripped. And after about 4 or 5 years, I was just out of control eating. And today I have people coming to me, probably 4 or 5 people a day, that did fasting, did keto, then they had their season of carnivore over about 4 or 5 years. And now almost to a person, they all have insulin resistance, like all of them. So that really, you know, my experience is foreshadowed what I think a lot of people are experiencing today, which is that there's short-term benefits to sort of fatty kind of things, and then real long-term liabilities that sometimes it takes years to work your way through, particularly in the case of insulin resistance. Like I'm seeing a lot of that right now. And, you know, that gets very serious. Like once you trip that, and it's sometimes going to be very difficult to fix that and gut issues. And probably 3 big issues we're in the jet wash of right now from all the fads of the last years. One is SIBO, one is insulin resistance. And anyways, you know, it's just, I see a lot of this stuff, and it really speaks to having a long-term sensible approach to protocols that seem new and cool. Mm-hmm. But you have to really understand that the attenuation is the norm for the body. So it doesn't matter what you throw at the body, you're going to see an inverted sine wave. You're going to see at the top of the sine wave and the bottom. So the top is the front end, and that's where you're taking all the selfies and, you know, doing the social media victory lap and, you know, going, it works. Here's my advice to you now, you know, what I do.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then what you don't hear about is the downstream negatives. And sometimes they're very, very serious, like, disrupted gut biome, insulin resistance, SIBO, all these things. So, what I put together in the immunity code was really this argument that we have spun so far out from what's actually true. Like, imagine a line here and this is what's true.
Yeah.
You know, we're way out here thinking this is, you know, what's new and cool is true. And there's this slap coming back to the center, which periodically happens just based on what's always been true, you know? And I tried to make that case in the book that balance is essential. It's not just a good idea. It's an essentiality based on how the body works. And a whole bunch of stuff we'll probably talk about today.
Yeah. And, you know, it's so interesting that you mentioned that, because I think so many people point to, well, you know, before, like in prehistoric times or in Paleolithic times, humans were always in a state of ketosis, or people would fast. But the truth is that
narrative
ketosis sometimes, and if they had the opportunity to gorge on whatever the hell it was, they would, and seasonally they did, and they don't live in the world we live in today. So, by the way,
yeah,
what's wrong with that argument? But the idea, I think what I gleaned from the book is the idea that you should have so much more bandwidth, and all of those things, like being in a state of ketosis or not eating 24/7 or, you know, fasting on occasion, like kind of using these levers to your advantage at different times, but not getting stuck in any one mode in any given time because it's you think it's the thing, is really the answer. Because what you're doing, in this book is getting to the bottom of it. Like, let's reset the microbiome. Let's address the gut health. Let's get our heads around the fact that the immune system is ultimately what's running the show here, which I think is a really interesting concept that I don't think a lot of people necessarily have thought of it that way. But when you, the way you lay it out, it's kind of like, oh, duh. Like, it really is.
Yeah, it's kind of intractable, actually, when you look at it. It's not something that we've really considered in a number of respects. But when you break it down, it's kind of like, oh my gosh, how did we miss this? You know, like a good example is we talk a lot about metabolism. So we talk a lot about metabolism within muscle, metabolism within adipose tissue, okay? But we never talk about metabolism within immune cells. Mm-hmm. And let's take the case of Crohn's disease, for example. You can make a really good case that, in fact, this applies to not just Crohn's disease, it applies to obesity as well. You can make a good case that it all begins with immune cell metabolism. And when you trace it back and you think about it, so you start in the gut and you look at maybe something like Crohn's, where, you know, really ultimately the issue in Crohn's is that you have TNF-alpha just permeating the lining of the gut. So you have this kind of massive inflammatory vector that is kind of steering the ship towards not resolving inflammation, but just keeping you in the inflamed state.
Yeah.
And then you begin to break down, well, let's look at what happens when the gut is resistant to TNF-alpha therapy. Okay, so one of the ways you get rid of Crohn's is you clear TNF-alpha, but there are a lot of people who are resistant to that. And when you ask why are they resistant to TNF-alpha being cleared? When you look at it, it comes down to immune function. So what you find is that there are there are very specific relationships between things like lipopolysaccharide and peptidoglycan. These are, you know, these are plant cell wall fragments, things like that, and sugar proteins. And they initiate a very key set of immune-centric reactions. So typically what you'll find is that the first culprit is toll receptor 4 on immune cells. Not on muscle, but in immune cells, toll receptor 4 in immune cells. And what that does is it interacts with cell surface proteins on immune cells, the CD proteins. These are called cluster of differentiation, in this case, CD14. Okay. And then what that does is you get this kind of like down daisy chain where it affects very specific genes and proteins, particularly NOD2 or nuclear mobilization domain 2. And these are proteins that have a lot to do with the sensitivity setting for things like interleukin-6 and very specific inflammatory triggers. So when you look at the cell surface of immune cells and look at how they do their thing, they have these sugar proteins that surround like these receptors for interleukin-6, and genes set the sensitivity on these sugar proteins. Okay. And so what can happen is like, you can have a genetic SNP for like NOD2 that basically takes these glycoproteins, GP130 is the one in this case, and it's just hypersensitized. So in this case, what you find is that the vector, the thing that steers the whole ship off course, is that when immune cell metabolism gets hypersensitized, they don't use glucose properly. So the metabolism of the immune cell itself is what's getting wonky. Okay. And then you get, they're really good at getting in the bloodstream and translocating, particularly finding body fat. They love to find adipose tissue. So what you find is that when immune cells, macrophages translocate and they wind up in your fat mass, that can sink the whole ship, everything. Right. That can sink everything. But from there, you can trace obesity, cancer, a whole bunch of things. And it all begins with immune cells. It begins with metabolism in immune cells. So, and when you just break it down, it's not that hard to see.
Yeah. And is that really why we talk about fat being inflammatory? Like, is that kind of that link, the those immune cells? Because we talk about fat being in and of itself, like excess fat. And you talk about good fat and bad fat. Like you have a really interesting, there's a really interesting section in the book that speaks to all fat. I mean, we know there's brown fat and white fat, but I think you take that discussion a step further. And speak to fat not as the, I don't know, it's just not the devil that we've made it out to be necessarily, but that it can be managed and through this whole immune lens to be not the demon that we've positioned it as, kind of thing.
There are some counterintuitive realities. Okay. Once we begin to look at fat, generally we associate a lot of adipose mass as just a negative thing. And there's a lot of truth to that. Like adipose mass, because of the sheer number of cells that you have, it acts as a vector controlling whole body, signaling whole body inflammatory cascades, the inflammasome, and, you know, it affects a lot of things, but it's, there's sort of there's a way of kind of parsing it a little finer, which is gets really to the signal state of your fat. And that itself is dictated by immune cells and immune functions within your fat. So, you can have a lot of adipose mass, but you don't have the populations of inflammatory macrophages or, ECM fibers, very specific fibers in the ECM that are what we would associate as being bad. You don't have those. And so I give the example in the book of this famous boxer who was a fat guy, he's fat, but he had good blood work. He didn't have all the inflammatory issues. And so what it does is it helps us understand that excess adipose mass is a huge risk factor, but it's not the only piece of the puzzle. The other pieces have to do with really the sort of the immune state of your fat. And what gets really interesting is when we begin to look at fat loss, and when we look at what happens during fat loss and what actually happens. And you know, I made this case in the book. I almost didn't want to make it because it almost sounds, you know, kind of it almost sounds a little arrogant. I don't want it to come off that way, but it just really, as an industry, we haven't dealt with what's true about body fat. And there's no way other than to just say it, which is that when you look at the weight reduced state, when you look at post fat loss, there are very specific immunological conditions, very specific factors that kick in, very specific sets of genes, very specific ECM fibers that are recruited, and you have a distinct physiological state. And it is that distinctness of that state that really quite probably will turn out to be a major culprit in weight regain long-term for most people. A good example that I've used is heat shock proteins. So generally we think of heat shock proteins as beneficial. We think, well, they're only good. They're just good. If you have heat shock proteins, that's good. But if you just take a second and think about it, cooking flesh generally is not a good idea. It's not good. Don't put your hand in a stove. It's not a good thing. And so the body, generally heat stress on the body is a form of injury. That's what it is. Well, the body has a compensatory mechanism for that. That's heat shock proteins. And heat shock proteins are what are called chaperone proteins. They're like little robots. They follow other proteins around and they help refold things and, keep things nicely origamied up. And that's what they do. And they do other things too, but they are actually a component of the immune system. And you can have intracellular heat shock proteins and extracellular heat shock proteins. And the same heat shock proteins within the cell, within the cytosol, can actually work negatively outside the cytosol. So the presence of heat shock proteins could be good. It could be bad. In the post fat loss, weight reduced state, what you find, not in all humans, but definitely a decent subset, is that you have the presence of heat shock protein 60. And what it does is it sort of creates an ongoing inflammatory state. And what that does is it polarizes immune cells, macrophages in the post fat loss state. And all these things together start to add up to kind of an immune centric approach to keeping fat off, where it's like, wow, have we factored in what's going on here? Because it seems that the body's reaction to just fat loss, which we think of as this benign thing, but actually the body registers it as an injury. And so the immune system kicks in. There's all these things that haven't been accounted for. And the more you dig into these things, it certainly seems very likely that they have a very, very significant role in the process of weight regain and a lot of other things down the road.
Yeah. So I guess you talk in the book about how to mitigate that. Like there's a good way to lose fat and there's a bad way. Like, I mean, you're not probably advocating for people just to hang on to their fat because it's a good thing.
No, you have to get lean. That's very important. I don't
think lean is super important. Yeah. And we need some fat. I mean, we can't function without it. At bottom line, if nothing else, it's an energy reserve. It's a buffer. It's a padding. It's hormones. It's so many different things. But so then the mitigation of that is basically this whole immune centric approach to fat loss, so that you don't trigger the bad actors or over trigger the bad actors. Yes. Okay. Well, you can elaborate on that. Go ahead.
I actually just came out with a course on it called Immune-Centric Fat Loss. And
I saw that. I'm like, I'm going to do that, even though I'm not allowed to do courses anymore.
The most important part of that course, I consider actually the end part after you've lost the fat. And once you've lost the fat, there's all these different things that you're, it's kind of a list of checkboxes that you're going down and you're checking off. For example, you're accounting for fibroblast growth factor 21. I can never, FGF21.
Okay.
So you're accounting for very specific genes, very specific proteins, very specific things like leptin and the gut microbiome, all these things. It's kind of like a series of settings that kind of get shifted and you're trying to set them where they optimally should be in order to mitigate weight regain. Example would be, so FGF21 it's a most properly called a stress protein. We used to think it was a fasting protein. We used to think, that body only made it during fasting and, helps you get lean and all these great things, but turns out it's also produced during feasting as well. So it's really more of a stress protein. Yeah. So much for that. Yeah. Yeah, everything always works. It's funny, the more you study the body, I think of a very interesting study that I read probably about 5 years ago, and it was studying It was studying basically like neural pathways in the way that neurons fire in a portion of the brain for visual recognition. And the study concluded everything does everything to everything.
which pretty much summarizes how the whole human body works.
Not super, very much, but yeah. So, but practically speaking, so looking at fibroblast growth factor 21, it turns out that there's a very surgical use for berberine, and that would be post fat loss to sort of mitigate FGF21. And so this is kind of like, you know, just kind of like a little practical thing that gets to something I tried to make in the book, which was that we are doing what I would consider baby talk, which is kind of taking things that really are best used kind of according to like, you know, what's the thing, when should we use it, how should we use it? That's really the best use. And then just kind of simplifying all that into like, you know, a thing is either good or bad. So, you know, high protein feeding is bad and plants are good, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And, but that's an example of a what, when, and how is that, when we begin to look at it, well, it makes sense to use berberine here, you know, it makes sense to use omega-3s here.
Yeah.
And so I just did a video on this today. There was actually a conference on this, just like a month ago, talking about the post fat loss state. And so, you know, the research is starting to recognize that there's a distinct metabolic genetic state post-fat loss. And it's very rudimentary. And you know, they're just talking about, you know, things like set point, things like that. But in 5 years, I can tell you what they're going to be talking about. They're going to be talking about fatty acid binding protein 4, FGF21, collagen 6A2. I mean, they're going to be talking about all the stuff that, that you know, I tried to kind of point out in the book. So that's where it's going.
So how does it, to the average person, I mean, they're all sitting there going, okay, cool. So losing fat is, and you actually talk about this in the book, it's virtually, as far as the body's concerned, it's an injury to tissue, which makes sense, right? It's tissue that you've managed to get rid of. So that's automatically tearing stuff away that used to be there kind of thing. And so you basically walk people through how now to calm the storm, or is it more in the way that you lose the fat, or, and I'm going to answer my own question. I'm sure it has to do with how you go about losing fat and then how you follow it up. And it goes way beyond this whole talk of set point, which is probably a gross oversimplification of what's actually happening at a cellular level, which is what you're talking about.
Yeah. What I did in the book was, I tried to create basically a overarching system to solve the problems we all face over time in the real world ecosystem. And I make the case in the book that if you really want to solve all of this stuff, all of it, just move to Madagascar and become a hunter-gatherer. And you're going to have a thyroid issue. You're going to have an insulin sensitivity issue. You're going to have But you're not going to have an egg allergy. You're not going to have anything.
Yeah.
No issues. Okay. And I did that to make the point that the real problem we're trying to solve is the problem of humans in this modern ecosystem we've created. That's the problem. And in order to solve that problem, we have to begin to inventory two things. What is most mechanistically true about how our bodies work, and then what actually really happens. No BS. Like, what's really happening? Do we really count calories forever, or do we kind of say we do, but we really don't? You know, like what's really happening? So that was kind of the overarching frame. And then one of the most important components in that is stopping this process of repetitive weight cycling, because that is so damaging long term. I'm speaking anecdotally from that, but there is an emerging body of evidence that strongly suggests that that chronic weight cycling is very damaging mechanically to your fat mass and to the body as a whole. It increases all-cause mortality.
Yeah.
And that's really what you see mostly. What you see is that because of this ecosystem, we get into our 20s, and then you start to see, you know, first a little bit of fat, the freshman 10, and then you get in your 30s, and, you know, it starts coming on. So you try all kinds of solutions. And ultimately what's happening is they are effective for a while, but then invariably you're regaining the weight. So what you're doing is you're mimicking feast and famine.
Yeah.
That our ancestors went through.
Cycles. Yeah.
But the difference is, and it's the key difference, our ancestors during the next famine had to get off their butts and go hunt something.
Yeah.
Okay. That's been subtracted in the modern ecosystem. We don't have that. All we have is the analogous refeeding or feasting period, but because of the constraints that most people live under for their time, they don't have the ability to mimic getting up and going and hunting again. And so what we're seeing with chronic weight cycling long-term is a number of like pretty serious things. One of them in all likelihood may turn out to be ECM fibrosis, which is that the surrounding support scaffolding for our body fat is getting stiffer over time. And the stiffer it gets, the less likely it is to want to shrink. And it kind of makes sense. If you think about scar tissue, if you're always scarring like a particular muscle or a particular area, it just doesn't work as well over time.
Yeah.
Like if you're always getting a bicep injury.
Yeah. Over time. Function. Yeah.
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 Well, so again, I tried to put the book ahead. There's an emerging body of research, small, but it's there. It strongly suggests that may indeed be the case. I think it's going to turn out to be exactly the case.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So, wow. So the infrastructure that holds the fat, if you will, gets stiff and more resistant to letting go. What about the idea that people talk about the body using fat to store toxins?
Mm-hmm.
Do you address that much? Surely that mm-hmm. ties into the immune story mm-hmm. as well, right? Because toxins are going to affect the immune system in some way, shape, or form. And mm-hmm. we almost talk about fat as being a defense mechanism of the body in certain cases. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, very much so. I touched on that briefly, talking about what you see with particularly like very high-end athletes when they're getting very, very lean. So one of the functions of body fat is to act as a buffer for things that otherwise cannot be ubiquinated properly or broken down through autophagy. So normally what our body does is, we have things that are, in the cellular milieu that ultimately we have to get rid of, or they're going to be damaging or they are toxins, and normally those things, the body has processes to get rid of those. But when the body's under a lot of stress, sometimes those processes can become compromised. Example is if you don't sleep, like you didn't get enough sleep. Well, then the ubiquitin proteasome pathway and autophagy, those things aren't working the way they should. Well, the body's got a backup system, and that is the body can sequester things like damaged fats or damaged particles in lipid droplets. They can actually sequester them in our body fat. And there's a phenomena where people who get too lean, like super, super lean, low percentages, they actually start putting fat on. And that is directly a result of stress and the body's compensatory mechanisms kicking in to deal with sort of like a lot of stress on the body and storing toxins in fat. So fat is very much a buffer mechanism, a backup mechanism to store things. And then they can be disposed of, in a way that doesn't hurt the body. Yeah, very, very real.
Yeah. So at the beginning of the book, there was a part where you refer to intermittent fasting kind of as almost a negative. And yet I feel like that's baby talk. So that's an oversimplification of what you're really saying, because I get the sense that in the whole balance of things, I certainly think you should be able to go a certain, like a number of hours without having to put food in your mouth for whatever reason. But I feel like what you're addressing is this, what I see happening in my practice is people get really used to intermittent fasting. It's convenient.
Yeah.
And they become what I call like chronic fasters, where just becomes the thing that they do, but they get stuck in this loop. As a matter of fact, I have a client right now who, he has a significant amount of weight to lose. I mean, if you talk to the OMAD crew, if you can restrict your eating to 2 or 3 hours a day, you're golden, man. You can eat whatever you want and you're going to be fine. And I'm like, here's the news. Eventually it just stops working like big time.
Yeah.
And gets so stuck.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is the problem with, you have a lot of modalities that are new to a lot of people. And so they're promulgating those, but they're not new. Like if you just in your practice, I'll bet you could do a survey sheet to every new person coming in and the same story on any modality, doesn't matter what it is, that it worked really well in the beginning and then, you know, it didn't work so well. And now I'm having this issue or that issue.
Yeah.
And that is how everything works over time. And if there was one thing I was going to impart to a consumer, which I just basically, that's all I consider myself to be, is just a consumer who took a bunch of advice over the years and most of it didn't work. And that's what got me here. It would be that you have to think about the long-term impact, the full cycle impact. So if somebody says, oh, just press all your calories into 2-3 hours a day, it works great. My answer would be, for how long?
Yeah.
Like, for how long? Well, what about the back end of that? What about like the sleep disruption? Whatever, you know? So the thing to understand that I would say on that is that fasting confers benefits. Those benefits can be listed. We can see what they are. It's like, well, it induces autophagy. Autophagy is mostly good, not always, but mostly. Helps with, a whole bunch of things. Helps with, it helps to replete NAD, blah, blah, blah. So we make our list and then we go and compare that to sleep. And we say, well, does sleep do this too? Mm-hmm. And then what we see is that, oh, wow, they're the same. It's the same list, but the only difference is that sleep is better. Sleep's actually stronger. You'll get more induction during sleep, and that's because sleep lets everything happen in its natural timing, its natural diurnal rhythm. So AMPK activation and all these things are going off when they're supposed to go off according to the body's diurnal rhythm. And so there's a way to look at that argument in terms of what we might say is signal strength. So the body. Really the benefits of everything that we're going after have a lot to do with signals that result from either the cessation of food or the cessation of certain elements in food. A good example is methionine. Mm-hmm. So when we lower methionine in the diet or we cease methionine in the diet, we get some responses that are very similar to fasting. Very, very similar. So when we begin to take a step back and I really take like a really measured, comprehensive look at fasting. The question becomes, well, obviously we want to correct sleep first because that's where all the bang for the buck is.
Yeah.
And then the next question is, well, how can we get more induction to the point where we're not getting negatives? So we're not compromising sleep. So mm-hmm. you can compromise sleep from fasting. You can compromise sleep from shifting your food cycles. Just by shifting when you're eating, you can change sleep onset.
Yeah.
So all these things have to be factored in. And then when we look at it, the next question would be, do we even have to fast to get this? Or better yet, could we amplify all the signal pathways and all of the effects of fasting without having to fast? And that's a whole new topic, which is amplified fasting, which I bring up in the book. So mm-hmm. all that to say that what you're going to find if you just kind of jump in the pool and just great works, I've heard people do it and I'm going to do it and I'm going to, fast 27 hours a day, it'll work for a while. And then probably in about 3-4 years, you have a lot of problems.
Yeah.
So that's my long-winded answer.
I think it's just too much of a good thing, right? I think the point that you make in the book is any one thing is not, I mean, other than maybe sleep. And even then you can overdo sleep, you can overdo
that's
anything.
Good point.
People
really good
will
point.
Continually say to me, oh, well, this is safe. You can't overdo it. And I'm like, I don't think that's how the body works. I think the body works in cycles and pulses and variation. Mm-hmm. And when we take that to the nth degree, what I really love about what you're talking about in the book is that if you reset that microbiome properly, if you address from the bottom up completely how your body's going to interact with the outside world, which is everything else that comes in, then you have like this plethora of options available to you, and you can now use things strategically when it makes sense, when it suits you. Like, to me, fasting should be an option that you can exercise when you need it or when it makes sense. Like, you're in an airport and you don't want to eat food. Well, I have the ability to skip a meal because it suits me, as opposed to, oh no, I could never go out for lunch with anybody because I don't eat lunch. It's like, well, like never? Like you gotta eat lunch sometimes. I mean, doesn't it ever make sense to you to eat lunch kind of thing? So it's just this idea of, I'm sure you're seeing it. Like, I think I get your emails and you constantly have these amazing success stories of people who followed the program as it were, and are just like dumbfounded. Oh my God, this actually works. And you're sitting there going, well, duh, no wonder. That's why I wrote a book.
I think it flies in the
face of so much of the dogma that's out there right now, that people are just shocked that they can actually get themselves back to a world where they can eat and live their life in seemingly a very not, it's not a life of deprivation. It's not super structured. There's a wisdom to it, and it's not haphazard, but it allows for much greater flexibility in terms of how you ultimately do your thing.
Yeah, thank you for that. I make the point in the book that and it sounds very contrarian. It's that, you know, this is not about a lifestyle. I don't care about that. You're already in a lifestyle. You're in the lifestyle of the modern ecosystem. So if you really want a lifestyle change, you know, again, go be a hunter gatherer. That's a lifestyle change. That doesn't solve problems. What solves problems is building skills. Building skills solves problems. And so I try to approach everything in the book as acquiring skills. And when all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. So, you know, when all you have is, you know, time-restricted feeding, then the solution to everything is stop eating. Once you begin to kind of look at, more very similar to martial arts, very similar, then what you begin to see is that there are different situations life presents you, and there's always an answer. There's always an answer for that. You just have to gain the knowledge to understand what it is. And I actually just made a video about what I call offsetting. And that is what I would offer is an essential skill for life. And offsetting is not avoiding. It is eating the thing that you're not supposed to eat, but learning how to structure combinations of things and timing and supplements in such a way that you can make measurable, real, meaningful differences in things like fat oxidation, postprandial glucose metabolism, postprandial thermogenesis, real measurable things. Now, I think the point I make in the book is that I've had a few experts kind of try and come at me, you know, because they think I'm trying to come up with some fake panacea, you know, like, and I make the point in the book that the problem that we're facing in the modern ecosystem is not one thing. It's about 30 things hitting you all at once. And each of them subtracting 2 to 5%, 10% away, making the slope that much more difficult. So the solution to that is 20 to 30 things that give you a 2 to 3% improvement.
Yeah.
And if you could just adopt three of those, okay, you could on a regular basis get a 10% improvement. Okay. In other words, let's say the slope of difficulties here, if we could just make it here, you have a much better chance. And if you could just apply a few more things. And so that's really what this comes down to. There was a really good paper that just literally was right out of what's in my book. It just came out, and it's talking about offsetting pancakes, which I talk about in the book.
How to mitigate pancake breakfast?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. And I have it in the book, and it's the same stuff. It's you use things like you want to time whey protein 30 minutes prior to pancakes. You want to add in goodies, like you want to add in red phenols, maybe a little olive oil, maybe some resistant starch. And what the study did was quantified the differences. And so the difference between the control and the experimental group was 23% increase in fat oxidation, 45% improvement in glucose area under the curve, and I think it was 20+% increase in postprandial thermogenesis. So what we've done is we've taken essentially what is a hack, and then we've quantified it, and you can begin to see that, oh wow, there's, you know, you're not changing the world, but you are making meaningful improvements. Mm-hmm. And if you could just learn more of this stuff, then over time, you've got sort of a skill set that will allow you to eat more or less freely in the real world and deal with the realities that we all face, which is time constraints. We're getting older, ad libitum eating. We all eat whatever from time to time, we're suddenly bringing the conversation into reality and out of the unreality of, oh, just make smart choices, things that people don't do.
But so was this about mitigating your IHOP pancakes, or is this about making a better pancake? Like using green banana flour.
No, mitigating the IHOP pancake. Yeah.
We're talking about mitigating the IHOP pancake. Okay, well, that's really interesting because I'm pretty sure the IHOP pancake does not have green banana flour in it. It does not
have
red raspberry kind of coulis on top.
No, that's it's funny. People that hang out with me, this is like an ongoing joke for a number of years. Like, we'll go out and eat, and they're expecting me to order like the grass fed, purest, pristine, floated down by angels from the, Rivendell, cow. And I'm ordering the IHOP pancakes, and they're like, how can you eat that? And I'm like, I'm just going to offset it. And they think, what do you mean? And everybody that knows me just knows this is all true. And they're always like, okay, wait, what do I do? But,
Have a bucket of supplements with you, or are you running to the bathroom like Tim Ferriss and doing 50 air squats?
No.
Like, so...
No. So here's the irony. Most people might listen to this at first and go, oh gosh, that's just BS. The real BS is the stuff that people are being told to do. The real BS is the stuff that doesn't work over time in the real world. Like I'll just make better choices, all that. Count your calories the rest of your life. That's the real BS.
Yeah.
Okay. And after 30 years of trying that stuff, this literally came to me one night because it was like 2006, and I was looking at all the weight I gained, and I went from 212 to 260 in 3 years. And I was just thinking, how could I have avoided this? What could I have done differently?
Yeah.
And I was looking at a meal, like it was a typical meal that I would go out on a business dinner, and I just started making notes like, I could have done this here and added that there, blah, blah, blah. And pretty soon I came up with, oh, wow. Okay. That wouldn't, that wouldn't mitigate everything, but it would make a nice dent in it. And then I could do this later, And so I started to come up with that. And when we begin to look at this sort of thing of offsetting, now we're talking something very, very real, which is like, I'll give you an example. I give this example of the book, and this is stuff that's documented. Like, there's a small growing body of evidence that is, but the cool thing about all this stuff is it's actually quite easy to prove. It's, like you can do studies on this stuff, and it's not that difficult to see. Like, you can measure. So the baked potato is an example where, like, we just take a regular baked potato, okay, and it just punches postprandial glucosylation curve. Looks like literally you're climbing the Matterhorn, okay?
Yeah.
But if you make one small change, which is to add a whey protein shake with that, you're going to get, a 10-15% improvement in that spike. It's not world changing, but it's there. Then if you make one more small change, you just back the shake off 30 minutes prior. Okay. You're going to get another incremental improvement. Then if you make one more small change, and that is you add a little bit of fat into that shake, just like a teaspoon of olive oil. That's going to slow gastric emptying. You're going to get another small percent improvement. And then you can keep going on. You can do things like cool the potato, add a little bit of butter to the potato, add some red phenols into the shake, add some berberine. I mean, you can keep going.
Yeah.
And so by just nothing other than knowledge, what you're doing is taking a weight gain meal and turning it into quite possibly even a fat loss meal. I'm not saying in every case, but you can dramatically impact very real parameters. And that is inching towards something that can actually solve the real problems that everyday people face.
Amazing. So you keep mentioning whey protein. So I have to ask you about whey protein, because, for example, someone like, I can't touch whey protein. I'll blow up like a balloon and fly to the moon and, be seen again and be miserable along the way. So does it have to be whey protein specifically, or can it be a different kind of, like, can it be, I don't know, like a beef isolate protein? Because I know whey protein has some very specific properties to it. Or can it be essential amino acids, like, a handful of essential amino acids, which is your protein with the fat and the polyphenols? Like, does it have to be whey, or are you just going after the protein here?
Based on everything that I have looked at, I would say that a really high quality whey is probably top of the food chain. But it doesn't preclude, like, pea protein also can very favorably affect, like, sort of postprandial, insulinemia, but, you know, can really have an impact. Hemp protein seems to work okay too. I haven't looked so much at beef protein. Can't comment on that, but I would, all that to say, whey is not exclusive. There's also, for the plant-based crowd, some very interesting stuff coming online now. Probably the most promising is chickpea protein. So chickpea protein, you're just starting to hear about it. The protein itself has oligosaccharides and just different things in it that really actually help insulin sensitivity. So that's a really good one.
Yeah. So that's really interesting. So chickpeas are interesting to me also, because there was that study done in Israel at, I want to say it's the Wiesenthal Institute, maybe. Mm-hmm. And I actually know what city it's in because I have a friend who lives there. and they looked at hummus, because hummus is this food that everybody in Israel eats pretty much. Sure. And for some reason, some people eat hummus and their blood sugar stays steady Eddie. Everything's cool in the world. Other people eat hummus and their blood sugar goes bonkos. Mm. And they ended up in this study, they ended up figuring out that it had to do with the composition of their microbiome. So some people have a microbiome that breaks down chickpeas in a certain way. Mm-hmm. And that allows them to eat it without this crazy sugar glycemic response, whereas other people were quite the opposite. So let's back it up to the beginning of the book where we talk about eating apple peels and HMO and all that cool stuff. I can't wait to try, honestly. Like, I get to eat apple peels every day. I think that's going to be kind of cool. That's really about healing the gut lining, but is there a piece of that because that's about the Acromantia bacteria, right? And then, like, it seems to me like with the book, like, you're very methodically going after the gut wall, then you're going after the microbiome. Like, once you've done that, do you think that people might become more tolerant of things like chickpeas? You know, like, I mean, I frankly, all the proteins you mentioned, I don't do that well with. So, and I know I have a far from perfect microbiome, so I know that there's work to be done there. But do you feel like once you've kind of addressed all those other pieces, I often believe that if you could rebalance a microbiome to be in a better state and have a gut lining that's in a better state, you're not going to see those food sensitivities and wonky reactions that we're seeing to all these different foods necessarily. I mean, you might still always react to egg white protein for whatever reason, but.
Yes, I would agree with that wholeheartedly. Not all, but a very significant percentage of the interactions that we have with foods are more an issue of either missing bacteria in the gut or the presence of bad actors in the gut. And that if you can recolonize the gut, which is not that hard to do, you can notice very meaningful and significant improvements rapidly, like very fast. So the interesting thing about chickpeas, they are so good at sensitizing insulin. Very good. I don't know that I've actually taken the time to investigate whether or not you lose some of that with hummus because you're grinding them up, mashing them up, and that affects the some of the longer chain like carbohydrates that are in chickpeas that help with that. But they're very good at sensitizing the gut. They're very good, particularly in combination with other foods like onions and asparagus, at sensitizing the gut. So what I've seen a lot, and what a lot of people have reported to me, is that they were able to rapidly make very meaningful improvements in foods they couldn't tolerate and that they eventually could tolerate. Now, the big, big, big caveat with all of that is the rate of adoption. This is kind of the thing these days. I just personally am seeing a lot of a lot of perturbed gut biomes from overuse of probiotics and also excess extreme dieting, excess keto, excess carb, things like that. So the thing to understand is that a lot of the foods that will preferentially feed the right bacteria in the gut, you have to start very slow with, very slow. Mm-hmm. And what I hear a lot, it's very common that I'm hearing right now, is, you know, they read something in my book and they're like, oh, wow, they're great, I'll do it. And they go and do, like, you know, too much of something and they literally have hyperinsulinemia, like literally like a diabetic fit, like just they're not clearing insulin and they're, you know, oh, my brain, I can't think, I'm foggy, I have no energy. And it's like, well, that's insulin resistance. But also you're not there yet. You have to, very much the analogy is these organs in the body are very much like muscles, and they, rather than running a marathon, you know, you want to walk around the block the first day and just kind of ease in very, very small amounts. And I'll also say, you know, there's no 100% solution out there. Like nothing works for everybody. You know, my stuff doesn't work for, I have a lot of people, very significant numbers that are like, oh my gosh, it's changed my life. But then there's also a percentage you come back and go, yeah, I'm worse. It didn't work for me.
Yeah.
You know? And so the body is so complex that the idea that we understand the body, you know, we don't, and we understand parts of it, but everybody's different and everybody kind of has to. So I advise, you know, going slow and caution with everything.
Absolutely. And you know what, when it comes to chickpeas, I've always, and I mean, in my family, like, yeah, I come from a background where chickpeas would be a thing. And I know that if I even knew that if I hadn't eaten chickpeas in a really long time, it was a slow, measured approach. Like you acclimatize to them. And I guess part of it is recultivating that microbiome diversity that can then break them down properly. And for the love of God, you don't eat the canned ones and not rinse them properly, because that's just death.
Oh, see, I'm so conditioned to those. I can just take them straight out of the can, not rinse them.
Yeah. So for me, like that was just not a plan.
Boy, that is, I'm really good to know, you know, I'm really actually glad to hear that.
Well, and that's people who aren't accustomed to it, right? Like to that, because if you look at that water, it's viscous. There's lots of stuff in there. And so to a gut that, as a matter of fact, my husband, who's got a steel gut, recently took black beans out of a can and didn't rinse them like I told him to. And he hasn't eaten black beans in a really long time. And the man with the iron gut was really unhappy for a significant amount of time, because he just couldn't, you know, his gut wasn't prepared. Because you know, it's not that they were bad, it's that his gut wasn't prepared to manage the influx of all of the different compounds that were in there that they just hadn't seen before.
Yeah, that actually gets to the case for working with a practitioner. So I'm not a fan of the indiscriminate use of probiotics, and that's what we've had, which is, you know, people just running and buying them off the shelf like they're Chiclets and chewing gum and doing them like crazy. Because you can do a lot of harm with that. But there is a very good case that I think is made where, because everybody's so different, you can try things that work on, let's say, you know, kind of the middle of the bell curve. They seem to work very well, but you'll run across cases where you have so little starter dose, so to speak, of maybe, you know, certain strains of bifidobacteria that you really need kind of some starter dough in there. And that's where working with a practitioner, you know, can really come in very, very, very helpful, because you can, our power to digest these foods rests in the genetic horsepower of the bacteria, but to acquire those bacteria and acquire them in the right place, sometimes, you know, you just don't have them in the right place to begin with, and you need a little help to get there. So, you know, what I try and tell people is, pertaining to the book, the HMOs that are up front are like kind of like a very good first step for just about everything. You know, they help with immunity. They're very good for spinning up the phytobacteria. And so, you know, start with those, and then add in apple peels. Like if you think you have an issue, just add them in very small amounts and see how you do. And most people respond very well. Some people can not respond so well for a couple of days and then they're better. What I hear a lot of is that, I felt a little nauseated the first day or two and then I feel amazing. And that's because the nausea was like polysaccharide from other bacteria dying. And then once that gets recolonized, the energetic B vitamin producing bacteria are there and you feel great. You're like, this feels great. Wow. So, it's there's a lot of nuance to this stuff.
Yeah. Can we talk a bit about HFOs? Cause I think a lot of people won't know what they are. I mean, you talk about using baby formula, but you can actually go out and buy HMOs. So maybe we could just briefly talk about HMOs. Then I want to ask you one other question and then we'll kind of start to wind it down. But
sure.
I mean, you're the multiple podcast guy, but let's talk a little, let's just, I mean, there's so much to unpack in what you do, right? But if we could define what HMOs are, because it's like the first step, right? Step one, go out and get the HMO and start consuming it.
Yeah. What I tried to make the book about was a series of small steps that you could just do one and change nothing else. Just do this one little thing and change nothing. Just do whatever you're doing. Just do this one thing. So right up front is these things called human milk oligosaccharides.
Yeah.
And these are specialized carbohydrates that are found in mother's milk. And they have a whole lot to do with the onset of the immune system in the human gut. And they basically bind things called histo blood group antigens. So they do a lot of things to help immunity get established in the gut. They also act as substrate or food for very beneficial commensal bacteria in the gut. And so generally speaking, they're sort of like a new class of wonder nutrients. And so when used properly, I think that they have a lot of utility. Mm-hmm. It's like anything else, you don't want to live on them. Mm-hmm. But used properly, they can be very, very powerful to help kind of get the gut, like, you know, sort of like optimized. Now, when I say that, I'm not speaking to conditions. So if you have Crohn's or colitis or something like that, you know, get with a practitioner and step through with a practitioner. So I'm not speaking to conditions there, but to kind of get the gut sort of like in a state resembling the guts that we see in the leanest, healthiest, longest lived people, they're a really good first step. And they cover a lot of ground. They are being used now in baby formula more and more because lo and behold, they did research and found that formula-fed infants tended to have obesity and breastfed infants tended not to have obesity. Yeah. And what did they find? Oh, human milk oligosaccharides were kind of in the center of that. So now they're putting them in baby formula, but you can get them direct now too. And there's about 50 of them. The one that's on the market right now is called 2-fucosylactose. And it's definitely like it's definitely a wonder supplement in a lot of ways. I put it kind of in that category with maybe like berberine or metformin, you know, in terms of its utility, like berberine or metformin. It's not something you want to use all the time, but used strategically, I think it adds a lot of value to the health equation.
And can people who don't tolerate milk use them typically?
Well, that's the key is people who don't tolerate milk can, I'm not saying in every case, but I certainly have examples.
Really tiny bits.
Yeah. If you titrate it in, I've had people go from being not able to handle milk to now it's no problem at all with that.
Interesting. Yeah. Because we peg it on a genetic predisposition that you either hang on to the lactase gene or you don't. Mm-hmm. And it's an end, like the enzyme that break down the sugars in milk. And, it's interesting. Yeah. Cause I wondered, like, sometimes I get people, I'm looking at their genetics and they should be able to tolerate milk, but they don't. And so we chalk it up to, oh, maybe it's a food sensitivity to casein or something else, but maybe what it really is the loss of that bacteria that was, and because to your point, like, you know, everybody's running to one side of the ship or the other, depending on what the flavor of the day is. And everybody's avoiding dairy. Everybody's avoiding this. Everybody's avoiding that. And when you starve out those bugs that were there to manage this stuff in the first place, suddenly you bring it back. Well, guess what?
You bring up a really good point, which I took a chapter in the book on this, and it's that when we speak of genomics, we have drifted away from what's most true. And what's most true is that the human body has three genomes, not one. And all of them are important. So you have the human genome, you have the mitochondrial genome, and you have the bacterial genome. Mm-hmm. And in the case of lactase persistence or lactose intolerance, the argument I make in the book is that we've sort of been looking at one side of the boat, which is that the theory of lactase persistence. But the other side of the boat is the idea that you can acquire the genes to digest lactose, and you can do it through bacteria that make the enzymes that have those genes. Huh. And there is, again, a small but growing body of evidence that supports that, that supports when you increase populations of very specific bacteria, Bifidobacteria, Lactobacillus, that people with lactose intolerance and gluten issues suddenly don't have those issues. And it really gets to the three genome concept that a good number of the genes that we need were never in the human genome to begin with. They are actually in the bacterial genome, and that can be acquired. So that opens up a realm of possibilities because the number of interactions possible between the bacterial genome and the human genome is in the millions.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of genetic horsepower, so it can't be ignored.
Yeah. And I think you, I love that discussion. I think it speaks to what I talk to people about, because, you know, you look at someone's genomics and you're like, look, this is really interesting and great. But I believe, and I think it's kind of a given, the body has so many backup systems. Like, there's so many backup pathways and different ways to skinny cat, some of which we know, and I'm sure gajillions of which we have no concept of. And, it's why it's so hard looking at it. And I mean, I love doing genomic testing with people because sometimes it gives them really interesting insights into certain things. But, you know, it's back to the broken record thing where I'm like, you know, like, these are predispositions, but they may or may not be true for you. Like, we're going to look at this and see what overlays with your reality and what we can leverage. But there's so many different other things that could be picking up the slack. And to your point, this microbial genome, which is grossly outnumbers ours, quite frankly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Like, what is it, 10 to 1 or something? Like, it's massive, the impact that it has. And so to move into a place where you're trying to recultivate diversity and a healthy balance in that microbiome and that microbial population, to be able to then be able to say, okay, I can have more options available to me because I have more players on board. It's kind of a sexy concept in a world where everybody's either eating all meat or all this or all that kind of thing.
Boy. Okay. You hit on so many things there. What you really hit on there is, a case I tried to make in the book, I hope I made a strong enough case for it, is that when you look at any disease, doesn't matter what it is, you're eventually going to use the word homeostasis, and you're going to say loss of homeostasis, okay?
Yeah.
Which the layman's word is balance, loss of balance.
Okay? Yeah.
And the point I made in the book is that when you look at the sustained imbalance of inputs into the body, it doesn't matter what it is. Even healthy things, when you imbalance them over time, you are going to create a loss of homeostasis somewhere in something, and we call that disease. Yeah. So we're in this era right now that is, really about the way to health is to imbalance your inputs. We're going to imbalance fats, we're going to imbalance animal proteins, we're going to imbalance something. And I'm probably going to talk a lot more about this just on social media, because if there's any one thing that's going to hurt the health of people long-term, it's that. And it's not to impugn any one diet. I think some of these diets that are out there are wonderful tool sets, the carnivore diet, for example. We really have Dr. Baker and Dr. Saldino to thank, because they've introduced a fantastic tool set that strategically has a lot of horsepower when used correctly and used strategically. As a way to eat for life, I think there's some, very significant health concerns that anybody should want to be aware of. One of them, for example, would be sustained high protein animal diets, probably going to give you insulin resistance just by elevating glucagon. And you're going to get sustained levels in serum glucagon by doing that. So, long-term, that's probably not a great thing. It doesn't mean that the diet isn't extremely useful short-term. There's some ways it can be used, I think, that it's just fantastic. But, And you see that with the keto diet. So you see sustained high fat diets have a lot of problems, probably not the least of which is they probably break the mitochondria long term. even sustained just low carb diets probably have liabilities. So across the board, you know, there's this idea that, you know, a healthy balanced diet is just boring. It's not sexy.
Yeah.
But really bringing us back to what's really true, it's probably a mechanistic necessity based on how your body actually works. So the body needs a variety of inputs.
Mm-hmm.
And what's polarized our thinking are narratives, which, you know, narratives are nice, they're useful, but they're not facts. Like, no one was there 300,000 years ago watching what happened. We don't actually know,
yeah.
to your point.
Yeah.
So, you know, but what we do know is that there's easy examples. You know, water's great. If you drink too much water, you'll kill yourself, you know,
yeah.
and you can make that case for anything. So, and that's really what I've been, you know, kind of my thing is that ultimately, after all, a healthy, balanced diet really was the best thing, you know, really is the best thing for a number of different reasons. We're just in this era right now that loves extremes.
Well, and I think, you know, I think extremes happen because of imbalance. And so like the pendulum will swing from one way to the other. It takes a hell of a long time for that pendulum to land back in the
yes.
middle, right?
Yep.
If
yep.
you think about it. And so I think the carnivore diet, to your point, like the people who are, and there are a lot of people who see massive impact, positive impact with that this carnivore diet. And ultimately, it must have been because they were in such a state of disrepair and imbalance that they needed this extreme to get themselves there. But I think the point that's getting maybe a bit lost is, and what you just articulated so well, is do you really think you can stay here indefinitely and have it be the right thing for your body? And, you know, I mean, I think that Dr. Saladino and Sean Baker would argue probably yes right now, but I will see, you know, I think we're just, we'll see. And it's yet one of another of the many, many big human experiments that are happening in the world right now. Right. It's just,
yeah.
Nobody's got the, crystal ball to really know, to necessarily know. Okay. I feel like I kind of have to let you go, but I wanted to ask you about one last thing.
Oh, yeah.
The biome testing. Have you looked at that at all? What do you think?
Do
you have any problems? And you can say, I don't want to talk about it, but.
It's all good. It's there's an interesting little secret in the nutrition industry today that a lot of the thought leaders came from the online advertising
Advertising industry.
Yeah, you wouldn't know it, but it's true. Like in the 2000s, mid 2000s, I was running a technology company in the search engine industry, and Naveen was at Infospace, which was, we were their customer. So, then Quest was my customer. All the principals at Quest, they were in the same industry.
Quest Labs.
No, Quest Nutrition, the bars.
Oh, Quest Nutrition. Yeah.
So we were all kind of in that camp, and now we're all over here because everybody, had their thing, and they wanted to get into what they were passionate about. So that's kind of an interesting little sidebar. But, I think there's an interesting discussion as to the utility of it. My opinion probably is that we're probably not getting like what we think we're getting, just because you're measuring the fecal biome, and there's a debate on, you know, are you really getting, you know, are you really getting the mucosal biome? Are you really getting the luminal biome? Or, you know,
right.
are you really getting a snapshot of those things? I don't think you probably are, but it doesn't say there isn't utility with it. I think the utility with that is probably for like, things like cancer risk or, you know, like disease sort of like diagnosis. I think that there's probably some utility there, like C. fusobacteria, that's not good. So I think in terms of though, just like the average consumer is going to look at those things and just think, well, that's my biome. And your biome can be changed very rapidly. Like in a week, you could probably change a good chunk of it out. And I think that would be an interesting experiment, would be to do the U-biome test on, someone kind of like on a SAD diet, and then put them through some protocols and, in 10 days, test them again and see what you have. That would be very interesting to do. So I think the jury's kind of out. You know, I don't think anybody really has the answer. I'm speculating on it, just my opinion, though.
No. Yeah, I think what's interesting about biome actually, is that in many ways, what they're moving people towards is a more varied diet. I don't think you'll ever see a Viome test come back. And I haven't run a Viome in 2 years.
Wow, so, that's a great point.
If you think about it, they will never say to someone, you should be carnivore, or you should, I don't even think they would say keto. If anything, they would say, okay, your tolerance for fat is here, so you can, but what I've seen of them, and I'm about to run another test with them only because I'm curious. Like, I haven't done it in a long time. I want to see how they've evolved. And, you know, Naveen Jain has always really talked about how Viome will become more powerful over time as more people use it and their AI becomes better informed, kind of thing. But one of the things I always noticed, I always thought about with Viome, was it was really interesting that it was always steering people towards greater variety.
Well, in that case, I never thought about that. That's a big deal. That's a really big deal, especially in this age. So I might have to reconsider a couple things.
Yeah.
That's,
I mean, they're not looking at things the way that you are necessarily. And I, you know, one of my frustrations with them back in the day was, oh, you need more acromancy or whatever the case may be. And at the time they were recommending probiotics, and I've inherently never really fully trusted probiotics, mostly because I don't think they get where they need to go.
100%.
And even if they do, there's not enough of them. And are they going to colonize? And it's like, I've always really believed we got to figure out a way to feed those buggers so that they stick around, kind of. Like, you got to cultivate your garden is my way of looking at it. And, you know, I'm sure there's people who've had great results with certain probiotics, but I've never really seen them do. I mean, for the most part, there's always exceptions, but as a general rule, but I don't think that, and maybe their food recommendations were geared towards helping to cultivate a more diverse microbiome, but they certainly were never asking people to eat apple peels with HMO, you know? So I love the intention and the methodology that you outline in the book about really kind of helping to reset and recultivate that.
You know, I can tell you, there's different kinds of proof. The most powerful proof to me is experiential. Like if someone gives you a suggestion and says, try this, and then you do it and it really worked. Okay. And then if it can be replicated over time, so it didn't just work once, but it seems to work whenever you do it. That's a very, very powerful form of proof. And so it's kind of a funny proof, but one thing I've consistently seen is that you can rapidly retune the gut with very specific foods. And the way you tell is your poop just doesn't stink at all. Okay. It's just like, it's just without odor at all. If anything, it's like menthol, you know, like I have a friend who calls it the equestrian bowel movement. And, you know, so when your bowel movement takes on an equestrian quality, you know, that's because of bacteria in the gut, and it takes about 6 to 7 days to do that. And it's a very powerful proof of, the power of food and substrate to affect the gut. Now, as to the makeup of that, you know, all that stuff, maybe that's where Eviome comes in, and we could take a look at that kind of thing. But just in terms of like a very powerful experiential proof, something that no one could ever convince me of otherwise, is that you can change the gut in very powerful, positive ways rapidly through food as substrate. And I've seen it happen just literally thousands of times. So that is something that I think is underserved. And it's, I think that's, if there's a nucleus of, you know, going forward for health at large for people, it's that idea.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I love that. Okay. Well, thank you. Okay. Well, I think we're going to wind this down because we could just keep talking, and we've been here for a while now.
Yeah. No worries. I'll ramble like crazy. So.
Well, as will I, and eventually drift off and, you know,
yeah.
So, Joel, why don't we tell people about where they can find you, how they can connect with you, how they can get their hands on the book.
Yes.
Of course, like the whole thing. Give us
the
package. Tell us.
Yes. Yeah. So veepnutrition.com, you can get the book, you can get the immune-centric fat loss course there. You can get the book on Amazon if you choose. There's some other goodies there you can get your hands on as well. So veepnutrition.com, V like Victor, E-E, P like Paul, Veep Nutrition. And that's me. And then my Instagram, come follow me on Insta. And, you know, I do my best to respond to people. And so I'm just playing the game.
Awesome. And so your Instagram is Joel Green or is it Veep Nutrition?
Oh, it's Real Joel Green.
Real Joel Green, as opposed
Real
to
Joel Green. The phony Joel Green. Yeah. There's another Joel Green out there who's I've never met the guy. He seems like a really nice guy. He's he produces some television show. And so when you Google Joel Green, it's either me or him that shows up. So he's, you know.
Amazing. Okay.
Yeah. So I gotta send him a message someday.
Yeah, you're gonna have to meet the guy. It's Real Joel Green with an E at the end, guys. So it's Green with an E.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just to be clear. Yeah. All right. Well, Joel, this was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me on. I actually just enjoy talking to you. I feel like we talked forever.
Yeah. Well, we talked for a couple of hours and it was fun. So thank you again.
Thanks so much. And we'll talk soon.
Yeah. I look forward to it.
Thanks so much for joining me on this episode of the Biohacking Superhuman Performance Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please remember to leave us a 5-star review on iTunes because that's what helps us to be heard and to be seen. If you'd like to connect with me directly, or if you'd like to leave any comments, or if you have any questions about this episode, please reach out to me directly through my website, natmidham.com. And of course, if you're not already a member of the Biohacking Superhuman Performance community on Facebook, that's where you'll find me every day. It's a short application. Just answer a couple of questions and you're in and interfacing with other amazing biohackers. Thanks again, and we'll look forward to seeing you on the next episode.